Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls, weekly two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We're seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 177, section 2, Jesus ministers to a young lad who goes on to write a pretty popular book. You really ought to read it sometime. Wonder what helped set this child of God on such a righteous path? Well, from paper 123, there were few homes in the Gentile world of those days that could give a child a better intellectual, moral, and religious training than the Jewish homes of Galilee, maybe Judea also. With us tonight, I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you're here with us. We've got Dr. Chris Halverson, Andrea Barnes, and Ruthie Wild-Wenger. And again, you're here. Please call up the text. Join us in our study. Join us studying the Urantia Papers. Take your virtual seat with us for about 1% of your week. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Thank you as always. And greetings. So welcome back, Ruthie, after your little time off. And hello to you, Andrea, and everyone who's managing to join us here live this evening. And for those of you who are listening in the archives, greetings to you as well. As Brad was teasing there, we are now going to get to the meat of the interaction between Jesus and John Mark, the famous young man episode here in the hills. We teased it forward, kind of set the stage last week, and we'll get a little bit of what transpired. Frustratingly, the midwayers just, as usual, don't give us everything that was said, but there's plenty to chew on about home life and parental love. So everyone sit back and put on as your reflective caps, as Brad was suggesting, and let's see if we can begin to embody these truths from the fifth epical revelation about family life.
Yes, let's bring them into our lives as a living reality. Let's have truth flowing through us, living truth. And good evening to you, Ruthie. Glad to have you back here. How are you this evening?
Great, thank you. One of my favorite parts of the book.
That's right.
Looking forward to it.
Very, very glad that we were able to, just serendipity turned out that we are getting to section two here just as you return back, and we're glad to have you here. Looking forward to it. And Andrea, glad to have you here this week. How are you doing? And maybe you can fill us in on where we were last week. What all did we cover?
Thank you, Brad. I would be happy to fill you in on what happened last week. The commentary after the review goes like this. And by the way, can you hear me okay? I've got a headset on and I can take it off and speak more directly.
No, you're fine either way. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep, you're fine. Okay.
While we all thoroughly enjoyed Brad's review, we couldn't help but realize the very stark seriousness of many questions he left us with at the end, including, have you heard, gentle reader, knowingly and persistently rejected these truths? Well, wait a minute, what happened to that sentence? Is that what you guys got in your file?
Just
hold
have
on,
you,
guys.
Gentle
I'm sorry.
Reader. It's all right.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've read this over before. Okay. Well, we should all be sobered to the realities of being taught. Boy, I messed up that first section. I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened. Living faith is the way we resonate with the Father and eventually fuse with Him. Without that divine righteousness, we will not experience an ongoing existence. Religion must be our mode of living. We discussed mistakes and how evil can be overplayed. Evil is not tied to the wholeness of our upper domain, merely to our unity. Imagine a sphere in our inner domain. If you imagine cutting a section through that sphere from any angle, you have a plane of unity. Within that plane, you may have evil that disrupts the unity of that particular plane. But unrighteousness is when every plane is corrupted by evil. We can let the wholeness of the Holy Spirit keep this from happening if we take delight in cultivating our scientific, moral, and spiritual insights. The conversation became quite deep and even more interesting. Check the archives for the full discussion, which you can hear starting at about 27 minutes into the broadcast. Because of the brilliance of revelation, many students may exalt themselves above other religionists and even fancy the opinion that they are better than those with the more superstitious notion about God. In paper 103, section 3, paragraph 4, we read, "Remember that in the religion of all ages, the experience which is paramount is the feeling regarding moral values and social meanings, not the thinking regarding theologic dogmas or philosophic theories. Religion evolves favorably as the element of magic is replaced by the concept of morals. Some people who found the Urantia book and then stumbled into a theologic conflict can fall into this category. If we are not careful, we could become part of that unwitting actual secularist group that early in the 20th century threw out morality when they threw out notions of primitive religion. Those unwitting folks have a so-called religion that is not evolving favorably. Yes, we need to remove magic, but it must be replaced by that living faith that has morality as its foundation. Anything else is a delusion. It is so self-evident, and yet we still seem quite clueless. Even our supposedly primitive ancestors understood this. Doing the will of God is not a burden, except to our ease-seeking lower domain." And then we started into paper 176, section 4, The Return of Jesus. Because the book states Urantia will eternally be one of the seven nativity spheres of Michael in the winning of universe sovereignty, we can rest assured that there will be nothing that will keep this planet from existing. We read also that Urantia is the sentimental shrine of all Nebadon, the chief of 10 million inhabited worlds. Therefore, nothing can prevent this world's continuing existence. Nothing. We discussed the word Armageddon and how it is an actual place where the orange man built up piles of rocks. It is also used in the book of Revelation. Humans tend to get fixated on places that we deem meaningful, especially if it's an ancient and supposedly sacred place. The three key sections from the Christian Bible that come into play in our reading when we were talking about the second coming include the book of Revelation, the book of Daniel, and chapter 24 of Matthew. If they were not in the Bible, it would be difficult to formulate or rationalize the reasons why he did not return long ago. We are reminded of what we read the week before when they say in paper 176, 2:4, "You behold me now in weakness and in the flesh, but when I return, it shall be with power and in the spirit. The eye of flesh beholds the Son of Man in the flesh, but only the eye of the spirit will behold the Son of Man glorified by the Father and appearing on earth in his own name. But we always want to hear what applies to us in the here and now and what will appeal to our outer life. We want to engage the revelation with questions, like in paragraph 3, we ask, why are they presenting two different options there, or two different ideas there? We reminded ourselves that about 100 years ago, our very own Machaventa Melchizedek became a vicegerent planetary prince, which complicates the conjectures about Michael's second coming. Now Michael and Machaventa will be in play as our future unfolds. But regardless of what Michael does as the creator son of our local universe in regards to Urantia, he must still finish what he started here 2,000 years ago as our bestowal son and a religious uplifter. That mission is not finished. In fact, it barely began before he was put to death. That job can only be accomplished by him. Could he come unannounced and as an isolated event?" Again, this section is very interesting and can be listened to again starting at 1 hour and 20 minutes into the broadcast. The book tells us, quote, "Be you therefore ever ready to welcome him on earth as he stands ready to welcome you in heaven. This is because upon death we are face to face with that same reality. If we remember the parable of the talents, we will heed this reminder and do our best to take the talents we have been given along with the truth we've been blessed to receive and make the very most out of it. The Master will require a reckoning. The children of light are all destined to see him. The children of light refers to those who are managing their lives using personality management, those who are aligned in righteousness in their inner lives. And then we started into paper 177. Wednesday, the rest day. This was the apostles' very last day of rest with the Master. After a quiet morning, Jesus spoke, reminding them to make sure that the truth abides in their lives and to daily grow in grace. As he made ready to go into the hills, David Zebedee admonished him to not be a fool and go out alone. He wanted three armed men to accompany him. Jesus told him, "No man will lay hands on me until that hour when I am ready to lay down my life in conformity to my Father's will." We found David's naivete at who and what he was dealing with to be intriguing. Offering our advice to others, even when we think they are going astray, can become a self-righteous and self-appointed mission that we are wise to stay away from. John Mark also wanted to go and made bold to request that he carry the basket of food. Then we started into section one, One Day Alone with God. All of us come up with rationalization schemes to get what we want. John Mark had deployed one of these for the purpose of being with the person he loved, Jesus. He told him that he would watch the basket and say nothing if he could be permitted to come along. As John and Jesus both held the basket, Jesus told him he could come and said, "We will comfort and console each other." We took a deeper dive into those terms, comfort meaning with strength or fortification, and console and console meaning the spirit of unification, that part of the spirit of truth that allows us to know we are not an orphan in the universe. For more about this, you can read in paper 194, section 2, paragraph 2. This event has become known on high as the day which a young man spent with God in the hills. Forever, this occasion exemplifies the willingness of the Creator to fellowship the creature. Even a youth, if the desire of the heart is really supreme, can command the attention and enjoy the loving companionship of the God of the universe, actually experience the unforgettable ecstasy of being alone with God in the hills, and for a whole day. Jesus told John Mark not to share anything they discussed that day, and John Mark actually did that. Jesus was here to represent the Father, and we know that our relationship with the Father is an intimate one. It's only between the two of us. Therefore, his admonition accomplishes the reminder of that special relationship that John Mark enjoyed that day with Jesus, and it's one that we too can enjoy with our existential Father. And just after listening to this, and that's the end of the summary, but just after reading that John Mark section, that I like to read my prayer book that's called God Calling, had this little tidbit that's just short, three paragraphs short. So imagine God saying this: "I am your friend, the companion of the dreary ways of life. I rob those ways of their grayness and horror. I transform them. Even in earthly friendships, the common way, the weary way, the steep way may seem a way to heaven if the presence of some loved human friend transforms them. Have you ever realized the wonder of the friendship you can have with me? Have you ever thought what it means to be able to summon at will the God of the world? Even with a privileged visitor to an earthly king, there is the palace antechamber, and the time must be at the pleasure of the king. But to my subjects, I have given the right to enter my presence when they will. Nay, more, they can summon me to bedside, to workshop, and I am there. When men seek to worship me, they think of the worlds I rule over, of creation, of mighty law and order, and they feel the awe that precedes worship. To you, I say, feel awe. Feel the desire to worship me in wondering amazement, but think too of the mighty, tender, humble condescension of my friendship. Think of me in the little things of everyday life. I thought that went perfect.
That's lovely, Andrea. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing.
And
thank you for that tremendous summary of what we were up to last week. I know that, we all have busy outer lives, and I know you've in particular had a lot of things going on lately. We're so grateful for the time you take to put those things down and so that we can order our thoughts on our website and just in our own minds here.
Well, thank you, Brad.
So,
thank you very much, Andrea. Including for the little sharing there. Yeah, the tenderness of the moment that we all cherish between Jesus and John Mark, is definitely captured there.
Yes, isn't
very
it?
Much.
Oh, I just thought it was wonderful. And to have picked it up so when that story was so much in my mind, and to read that and to really feel that. That little prayer book and this Urantia book, oh man. We really hit the jackpot, folks.
It's delightful to walk through this world being a truth seeker, on our best days. There's some days I can barely string a sentence together and just need to try to fry myself an egg and keep myself fed. But I try to be a truth seeker, and you can recognize truth anywhere. This book in particular, Andrea, I know you've mentioned it before. It seems to have very much been written in a truthful manner, but you can spot it just about anywhere, and you can and I know it can be the height of fashion sometimes to say, I wonder if this author reads the Urantia book, but really all you have to say is, I wonder if this author is a truth seeker. I wonder if this author has access to the same spirit ministries we all can avail ourselves of if we practice those favorable conditions.
That's a
what's
great
more likely
point,
going
Brad.
On.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
great
not
point.
To mention, has this author humbly reflected upon the truth that comes through what people like John Mark wrote in the Gospel of Mark? And despite the confusion and ignorance of those who wrote things 2,000 years ago, nonetheless, someone today, in humble reflection, can strike step with truths that you can find very clearly written in the fifth epical revelation. And it's one of the ways that you experientially validate the fifth epical revelation. If your humble, sincere reflection, didn't find a synchronization with the revelation, you'd have this conflict you'd have to deal with. Right? I mean, you could always say, well, perhaps, I'm at fault here. But, the revelators are saying, actually put us to the test. We'll assume that you're being sincere in the truth that you believe you recognize, and if the revelation doesn't meet that test, hold us to account for that. And I've said it many times over the years, challenge the revelation as best you can. If that challenge is sincere, you'll find it to be exactly what it says it is. It could be nothing else.
I was talking to a friend the other day and yesterday, and Claudia Ayres, she won't mind me mentioning her name, but we were talking, there was a couple people in the group talking about how we found the book, and she said, it was her brother, and she thought, oh, he's really lost the plot here getting into this book. And then mom got into it. She thought, oh, I got two crazy people in the family now. So she read the book. She would take it over to the library at the university, and she would go through it and then try and find things that would refute it. And she said she went for about 3 or 4 months, and one day she was sitting in the library, and something hit her, and she closed the book and said, oh, my God, there is a God. She said she was a total atheist. So she gave it a good chance of trying to refute it. Didn't work.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, I mean, if you're not sincere about this, you know, this can, yeah, you can play it, you know, positively or negatively against the revelation. You know, let's take the side that I often highlight, you know, it's a revelation and not an affirmation. You know, you could do what you think you just heard me say, and you know, go, oh yes, I find all these passages that seem to have an immediate resonance with the way I've always thought about things. Yeah, so I've done it. I've experientially validated it. No, you know, I'll bet you there's some passages that you haven't read or that you couldn't find a resonance with and kind of went around and no, see, so. Yeah, you've just proved that you can rationalize anything, and you found affirmation in something that isn't actually affirming. It's a revelation. Yeah, so you know that experiential validation, you know, is in that synthetic mode that Brad mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast. You haven't found truth within yourself if in this process of synchronizing with the revelation there are parts of it that you find in dissonance. You know, you have to meet it wholeness to wholeness. It has a wholeness. But you can't experientially validate that wholeness if you know not wholeness within yourself. You know, so you can do this deceptive part-wise to part-wise seeming validation, but that's just affirmation.
Yeah. And it seems to me through the several now generations who have grappled with this book, you know, some have made it their life's work. It seems like we've all had to sort of engage in some sort of aggregate enterprise to try to get at these things. I'm just not sure that a reader with one of the hot off the presses books in 1955 could have struck step with it. I mean, anyone can pick it up and just read it cover to cover, or read it three times to read it for the first time, as they say about the great books. But I certainly know I appreciate that you know, as flawed as any understanding may be, that came to me as a second-generation reader, I'm still to some degree standing on shoulders of those who came before me. I was blessed with some partial understanding of this thing even as a teenager. And now it's been a long road to get to what I hope is a more holistic understanding, a recognition born of myself, not of tradition and authority. But still, it's amazing that this 2,100-page book was just sort of dropped here and without a personality to teach it to us, and we're trying to grapple with it.
yeah, we sure are.
And you know, and in doing that, like I was just saying, so you're grappling with yourself, not merely with it. You know, so that's why, you know, I've often pointed out, you know, the way that ancient Greek insight of know thyself comes into play with the fifth epical revelation. You know, you can visualize it, you know, as I often do, of you know, you have to first know thyself and have a synchronization with human philosophic possibility of recognition, you know, that is a lower hemisphere in analogy, and then match that up with the upper hemisphere of divine revelation from the fifth epical revelation, and, you know, and have a whole sphere then to work with, know, you can think of it that way. You know, but just you know, the essence of that is what we're touching upon here. That you know, it makes a great demand of you. You know, it's you know, it's very much like when you don't have the post-Pentecost by grace assistance of the Spirit of Unification. The Spirit of Truth is the Spirit of Unification to bridge the gap between you, the seventh circler to begin with, and third circler state of mind. The adjuster technically can only reach down to third circler. And, you know, and
wow,
that hasn't changed post-Pentecost. It still can't reach down below third circler, right? And so you have to reach the west rest of the way up, right? I mean, you know, it's, you can just kind of see the upper hemisphere, lower hemisphere parallel here to what I was just saying. You know, we're talking about bridging this divide between the truths of eternity and you down in time. And, you know, if you can't even get to the factual nature of yourself and the world that you live in, you know, that greater sense of the facts of time, you don't possess that lower hemisphere to match up with what's coming down from above, you know, the truths of eternity. So it's just very unfortunate that there's a lot of people that still have this very magical concept about themselves or about the upreach process. You know, that, you know, effectively makes them think that it's all just sort of just there, and God can engage you without any reality of upreach, and it's just not the physics of it. You know, and then, you know, I know a lot of people kind of appreciate the Spirit of Truth as the Spirit of Unification bridging that gap between seventh circler and third circler,
right.
And they will sort of invoke in response to what I'm saying, yes, but now we have the Spirit of Truth that bridges the divide, so we don't really have to upreach anymore. And it's like, that's not true. And as it tells you directly in this, you know, in the Revelation, you know, how much the Spirit of Truth can bridge the divide as the Spirit of Truth, you know, not just merely as the Spirit of Unification so that you can get an adjuster, technically. You know, but what we're talking about, bridge this divide between the blob of protoplasm, you know, and the truths of eternity. You know, the effectiveness of the Spirit of Truth in that regard is wholly dependent on how much you've taken delight in cultivating, spinning up your relationship with the means to that end, the Holy Spirit. And it's, you know, it couldn't be clearer in the Revelation that in that regard, that bridging regard, the Spirit of Truth is, you know, can't do much of anything until you've extensively taken delight in cultivating and spun up the means for that. You know, it's like thinking that somehow the Spirit of Truth can be poured out upon all flesh without the Spirit substrate of the Creative Mother Spirit.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. Yeah,
it doesn't happen. It's impossible. And so you need that means to that end. And if you don't have that means, there is not that end. And so you haven't bridged that. You can't get to the truths of eternity in the Revelation because you are not an adequately upreaching fact of time.
Well, as much as I tried to give due credit to the shoulders that I stood on through the culture I was given as a child, you know, you also got to call a spade, I definitely soaked up some of those problematic false orthodoxies that people have come up with where it says, well, you don't have to upreach. For the last 2,000 years, everyone gets a free ticket to heaven. Thought adjusters, spirit of truth poured out on all flesh. So, you know, just sit back and eat your Cheetos and enjoy the ride. And it's like that's not taking delight in any cultivation at all there. That's the lazy animal deliberately or undeliberately misreading a revelation.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the spirit of truth is poured out upon all flesh. It doesn't say the spirit of truth is fully, effectively functioning within all flesh.
Right. Didn't soak in. You know, just run right off you, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's there, right? But it's fiddling its thumbs.
Yeah.
It's nothing. It does not have the means to work with you. You know, it's, you know, again, it's, you know, it's a ministry that in many ways is designed to augment third circlers.
Right. I mean, you can see on the day of Pentecost when it first swept into the room of our very notable figures, like it had a profound, pronounced effect on them that day immediately. But these were advanced spiritual people who had been in the direct company of Jesus for 3-4 years. I mean, that may not be surprising. I mean, it's also swept across the entire world at that same point, but probably didn't have as much of an effect as it did on those people in that upper chamber that day.
Right, and, you know, and a lot of it was just, you know, not so much an enduring illumination, but, you know, the connection of the spirit of truth produces a heat spike in your mind.
Yeah.
You know, that gave them, you know, a quote-unquote, as we like to call it, a spiritual warmth. But that, you know, that fades. You know, there's lots of things that we can do that give us one of these quote-unquote mountaintop experiences where we get this little heat spike.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it always fades, and that's why we, you know, become this drug addict where we try to repeat repeatedly. And, you know, and it's like, if that's not what life is about, you know, to feel those heat spikes. So, you know, again, if, you know, even with the apostles, you know, they wouldn't, at that same time that they point out how they definitely felt something. You know, it also says that, you know, they immediately on that day began to speak mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Not so, truth. Mistakes.
In other words, darkness came out of their mouth, not some, you know, perfect light now, you know, of the spirit of truth just, you know, flowing out of their open mouth now without any hindrance.
Right.
Yeah. Right, a mistake is darkness, not light. So, and again, it's, you know, it's because of what I've been saying. You know, we don't want to think magically about the spirit of truth. You know, and it's and it gets back to that quote that I brought up last week that Andrea put in the review about religion evolves favorably as the element of magic is replaced by the concept of morals. And, you know, and just the immediacy of what we're pointing out here, the reason for that contrast between magic and morals is because there's real physics to morals. I mean, it's bringing that physics we're talking about into play, whereas magic obviously
right.
doesn't. That's just wishful thinking. Yeah, we can wish that we had the full benefit of the Spirit of Truth, but that doesn't get us anything.
Sure.
Can you wish? Well, can you wish to have better morals? Does it work like that?
No, you can only supply the favorable conditions, to have that grown within you. And don't immediately go to, the specifics of loyal, humble, sincere, just, patient. Think in the more conceptual way about the favorable conditions. Knowing that morality, that righteousness are the foundations of religion, of faith. Right? I mean, just knowing that, right, prevents it from, floating out of view. And your efforts just becoming self-serving humanism.
Hmm.
And it's just so important to, it's that focus on that foundation that allows the physics to be there so that all of these higher concepts aren't just delusional, magical thoughts.
Almost like early home life and education of young children is important to set the foundation for them so that they can have more favorable experiences later in life.
We'll see the foundational argument being the drone tone of everything we're going to read tonight about the interaction between Jesus and John Mark. To try to distinguish between magical notions about love and real love.
Good.
This emphasis that I do so frequently here of late on that, don't forget the foundation. You can think of it in very direct terms of, it's the foundation that establishes the physics, the nature, the reality, the real nature of what we're talking about, so that it isn't just, it's so wonderful to use this word, and let's all imagine that we are this word, like love.
It's an old wineskin, taking a word that you think has magical, incantational powers and maybe thinking just by invoking it in and of itself, you'll summon the ghost of love or something and it'll possess you and you'll just inherently orient yourself rightly. I mean, it just sounds like sort of another form of magical thinking or shamanism, which are primitive notions, and we're called on to do more than that now.
Yeah. It's so important, to see the relationship between the fourth epical revelation and the fifth. That, in the fourth, Jesus of Nazareth made clear what he would like us to add to our maturing religious nature. But in the 2,000 years since, we've taken the eye off of the foundational necessity. And so without that foundation, we're trying to add something upon nothing. and wondering why it just doesn't seem to be working.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you go back and look closely, you'll notice that Jesus was telling you to add what he was saying on the foundation of what must be there to begin with, right? Add the first story to the ground floor, as it were. In your excitement about what the world would be like if everyone had that, that floor above the ground floor, you've forgotten that there is no such thing as a floor above the ground floor without the ground floor.
Right.
Yeah. You know, just you know, making sure that we don't lose sight. And just to see, you know, no matter where you are in the revelation, you have this, you know, it might not be the part of the story that's as shiny to you, and so you've missed it or you don't give it equal weight in your mind, but it's there, and you should give it equal weight. Sometimes it's, you know, it's literally understandable as in the two-eye analogy, right? And you know, you've been only looking at the story with one of your eyes, you know, and to notice that you can close that eye, and there's the other eye has a full, complete story there too.
Mm-hmm.
That there's just as much about that other eye sees as, you know, as the former eye. So, you know, and so see both, open both eyes, and put the two together, and then you'll get the truth of what's being said by Jesus. You know, and like I said, you can actually begin to see, oh, I see why the fifth epical revelation is here in an emergency situation, because people have gotten so spun up by what Jesus said that they see with the one eye, but they've forgotten the foundational eye, and now we're going astray. You know, and so it becomes, you know, Jesus wasn't in rebellion in that he was giving us something divorced from the proper foundation like Caligasta and crew were.
Right.
But we've done with what he said, you know, effectively exactly what Caligasta and the rebel staff did. Right? We've taken on something without its foundational necessity.
And we're trying to study here how to have that restored, yeah.
Yeah, we've imposed the rebellion upon ourselves.
It just seems like because we've talked about this before, how we're potatoes soaking in this broth, and we don't even see that we're soaking in the broth of the Lucifer rebellion. It's like, how would you figure this out unless you had a revelation to help you? And it just seems like it's the full flowering of all of these issues that have been going on for so long. It looks like we might have tried to get it together, like you said, at the beginning of the 20th century, like we were finally figuring some of it out. But, gosh, I don't see how we can get back there. I mean, people are just going 180 degrees the wrong direction.
I will say that we've got Van, who was able to figure this stuff out. I mean, he was well educated, but he had clear thinking, wise reasoning, logical judgment, sincere motivation, unselfish purpose, intelligent loyalty, experiential memory. It goes on and on and on in paper 67, like the attributes that can allow you to see through sophistry, even when it's like when you're soaking in it, you know, when it's all around you in Dalmatia. Van saw through it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's always been a way. I mean, that, you know, just because there was a rebellion doesn't mean there isn't the light of revelation still accessible to you. You can pick up the Bible. You know, it's still the case that you aren't absolutely prevented from accessing that book. And you know, and reflecting therein and going, it appears to me that what all of the prophets have been saying for centuries is in direct conflict with what the world is telling me now.
Right.
I need to choose. Okay? I mean, again, it's not like there hasn't always been deception afoot. And people have, you know, have rejected it for the truth, you know, in what they deem to be revelation. And so it's still there. See, it's just, you know, think about how many people, you know, well, you can't go to the Bible. That's a discredited, superstitious text.
Sounds like a preconceived opinion to me. I held it for a long time, too.
Right.
Yeah, I've heard it called the Big Book of Jewish Fairy Tales, and I laughed at that.
So if you throw out, at least in the Western world, the text that embodies the best of all epical and self-revelation over all of human history, yeah, you have no, means to discriminate. What's your standard of goodness then?
Mm-hmm.
Right. See, so that's where we are, and and so many people find the fifth epical revelation with that mindset. They've thrown out the Bible, and they throw out unwittingly, at least, everything in the Urantia book that smacks of the Bible as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I first found the book, and I was really interested, and then all of a sudden I realized, oh, wait a minute, the whole last part of this book is about Jesus. I almost walked away from it because I thought this is just some other, hocus-pocus thing, and I wasn't interested, but then luckily I stuck with it and kept going to study groups.
But again, even there, just notice that there's this, it may be a hierarchical bias, but there's a bias. Some, have the bias to a lesser degree than others, but nonetheless, there's this tendency, let's just skim the cream off the top. We don't need that foundational stuff, which the more you dig into it, is gets more and more into the Bible, even the Old Testament. Yuck. Right? There's this bias that we've all been marinating in, like you were saying, Andrew.
Yeah.
And that must be overcome. Because, you're thinking that somehow you're going to have the truth of the fifth epical revelation upon the foundation of rejecting the truths of the first four.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Well, part of the challenge there, my personal story, I don't know that I looked and discussed at the Bible, but I think even the Urantia book says, it is a superb Christian document, but not only meagerly Jesusonian, if I'm remembering words correctly. And, for me, there was always something that I felt like I wanted to be able to find something in the Bible or Christianity, and I tried many times, and there's just an intellectual block. I couldn't, there was too much that was unrelatable because I didn't have a certain context. And for me, reading through paper 99 and just the more I'm reading through all of this, that actually liberated me to have a better context. And I am much more engaged in Christianity than I ever have been because of reading the Urantia book.
Yeah. One could even argue I might be overemphasizing of late, but again, it's to try to break through. You can't do this skimming the cream off the top thing, thinking, oh, I definitely am separating myself from the primitiveness of the Old Testament. So you're telling me that it's not true? That the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish? You're telling me that's not true? In the first Psalm?
That's true.
Right.
Always been true, always will be true.
Yeah, and that person that you say, you're skimming is, the cream off, from the Revelation, that Jesus guy, he quoted that. He quoted the first Psalm. It's true.
Held it up.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. It's true that God is a God of love, and it's true that the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. Both of those are true. They're talking about the same God. And if your God doesn't embody both of those, you're not, you don't believe in the real God. You believe in an exalted affirmation of yourself.
That's what it always seems to come back to, yeah. And you know, maybe it is a little overemphasized here, but I mean, I'll take it right now because this message is easily lost in the wider world, and I think it's even lost amongst a lot of readers of the Urantia book, even ones who've read it for many, many years. I'm speaking for myself. This larger recognition didn't dawn until embarrassingly recently in my life, but I guess better late than never is the aphorism. So,
if you don't hear it while we're studying the Revelation like this, you're not going to hear it the rest of the week. What ungodly person in the world is going to remind you of this? It warrants some emphasis. Like the revelations would say, always remember. Like, for instance, when you're not listening to Symmetry of Soul, and you listen to hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of other voices diffusing you from the truth, are you always remembering in the midst of all that diffusing influence that's trying to exalt humanism over God?
It's something to watch out for, especially if you're like me, someone who's prone to wander into the ways of humanism and politics. I've tried to set a watch on myself, for sure. I try to watch myself like a hawk because I've come to know myself a bit. So,
yeah. Nice. There's that knee-jerk reaction out there of, there aren't ungodly people, Chris. They're all children of God. Okay. Yes, Lucifer, for instance, is a child of God. He's also iniquitous. What's your point? you can get so, it's that humanistic exaltation that plays upon these terms like child of God and makes falsehoods out of them. Just because we're all children of God doesn't mean there isn't evil, sin, and iniquity. You've got to discriminate between the evil children of God and the good children of God, between the righteous children of God and the wicked children of God.
Yeah. Ruthie, was there another comment you had there?
Oh, just a small one. I just in this sort of grappling with, trying to keep a balanced idea of God in our minds and hearts. I've just hearing so much throughout my life, God is love, which has been serviceable in a certain way, but I don't need to beat a dead horse of problems that can arise if that's not understood properly. I've just added God is law and love and kind of rehearsed that in my mind and still has love. There is law, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can add it explicitly like that in your mind, and you can even take it up a notch and recognize that if you just say God is love, okay, that focus on the word God, okay, you're talking about some fact, right? The fact of God is love. Well, the fact of God is the divine law. Saying God is love is saying both law and love at the same time. If you think philosophically, logically about the sentence, God is love.
It is in there, yeah.
Your notion of God doesn't have to be the fact of God, and hence the divine law. Right, that notion of God that you say is love, okay, doesn't automatically include the law. But the real God is a real fact, and the fact of God is the divine law. law is life itself, not the rules of its conduct.
Yeah. I'll probably be reminding myself that God is law and love for a while, though, because I am prone to wander. And I held in my mind a notion of God for a very long time, and I'm working on not being there anymore. But I don't fully trust myself. I'm trying to trust God. So
yeah, yeah. So definitely do that. Yeah. Tattoo it on. You know, tattoo love on one hand and law on the other hand, or whatever you have to do.
There you go. All right. Shall we get to our reading?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's terrific reading, so let's Yay. Get to it. Let's commence. Yay. We're in paper 177 of the Urantia Papers. That's titled Wednesday, the Rest Day. We're starting in Section 2, Early Home Life. On page 1921 of the original single column publication. So this is Jesus and John Mark, One Day Alone with God in the Hills. In the course of this day's visiting with John Mark, Jesus spent considerable time comparing their early childhood and later boyhood experiences. Although John's parents possessed more of this world's goods than had Jesus' parents, there was much experience in their boyhood which was very similar. Jesus said many things which helped John better to understand his parents and other members of his family. When the lad asked the master how he could know that he would turn out to be a mighty messenger of the kingdom, Jesus said,
maybe just one little thing of note there. He spent considerable time comparing their early childhood and later boyhood experiences, in that whole context of Jesus telling him not to relay all this stuff that they talked about. So you notice that Jesus, wanted his public ministry to be what kind of carried forward, not his private ministry, either during the public ministry times or before the public ministry times. And one of the things the fifth epical revelation is doing, we see, which is not appropriate in the fourth epical revelation context, that's why Jesus forbid people, is bringing in what happened before the public ministry and in private moments with Nathaniel or something like that, during the public ministry. So just to appreciate that, these one-on-one asides like this are too complex and potentially confusing to put in the immediate context of the fourth epical revelation.
Right.
So, if you see your mission to really pick up the ball that the apostles and disciples of Jesus dropped and bring that fourth epical revelation forward, you can't, you have to take a vow of silence like John Mark did about all the things that you know about that went on in private and aren't part of what, puts forward just that pure message, about the ideal of the spiritual father in the context of the fourth epical revelation.
Hmm.
Interesting to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. As we've talked about many times, this is you have to remember that just constantly part four in the fifth epical revelation is not appropriate to a fourth epical evangelism.
Hmm.
Yeah. That's something to think about.
Yeah, it's not. Comparing their early childhood and later boyhood experiences is not fundamentally about the faith of Jesus.
No. No, it isn't.
And it's going to make it more and more about Jesus himself, the very intriguing blob of protoplasm that can't, occasionally did free food and free health care. Yeah, which is also not about the faith of Jesus.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that if you get too far down the rabbit hole, you will forget that it's the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. You will drop that adjective religious, and you'll think that of all human knowledge, it's the life of Jesus and how he lived it. No, it's the religious life of Jesus.
Yeah. See, it's just the faith of Jesus. I mean, Jesus of Nazareth, his faith is the ethical revelation, not his life and teachings.
Yeah.
Faith is the revelation.
All right. I know you will prove loyal to the gospel of the kingdom because I can depend upon your present faith and love when these qualities are grounded upon such an early training as has been your portion at home. You are the product of a home where the parents bear each other a sincere affection, and therefore you have not been overloved so as injuriously to exalt your concept of self-importance. Neither has your personality suffered distortion in consequence of your parents' loveless maneuvering for your confidence and loyalty, the one against the other. You have enjoyed that parental love which ensures laudable self-confidence and which fosters normal feelings of security. But you have also been fortunate in that your parents possessed wisdom as well as love, and it was wisdom which led them to withhold most forms of indulgence and many luxuries which wealth can buy while they sent you to the synagogue school along with your neighborhood playfellows, and they also encouraged you to learn how to live in this world by permitting you to have original experience. You came over to the Jordan, where we preached and John's disciples baptized, with your young friend Amos. Both of you desired to go with us. When you returned to Jerusalem, your parents consented. Amos's parents refused. They loved their son so much that they denied him the blessed experience which you have had, even such as you this day enjoy. By running away from home, Amos could have joined us, but in so doing, he would have wounded love and sacrificed loyalty. Even if such a course had been wise, it would have been a terrible price to pay for experience, independence, and liberty. Wise parents, such as yours, see to it that their children do not have to wound love or stifle loyalty in order to develop independence and enjoy invigorating liberty when they have grown up to your age.
I guess the first thing I would say is, what are your thoughts, Ruthie?
I feel like this is going to be very anticlimactic.
it's a beginning.
Really,
you're not trying to climax the discussion. You're trying to begin the discussion.
I mean, every sentence, I'm like, sorry, on the spot, I feel like I can't start, but I'll jump in.
I know it wasn't fair for me to just put you on the spot like that, we have a husband and wife couple. There are thoughts about what Jesus is talking about here, and it's important that we bring this forward. I'll just put up front what I've hinted at it a little bit ago. Is it not obvious already what the foundational point Jesus is going to make here? I mean, love, yes, but not love divorced from a foundation of wisdom, in the context of wisdom, if you want to say it that way, because love... without that wisdom is what? It's false love. Love without that wisdom is that malignant virus. Yes, love has the potential of being that benign virus, but it must be true love. And love is not innately true. You have to context it thus. You have to encompass it thus. You have to choose the trueness of love. And you can equally, unfortunately, seemingly appropriately to you, choose false love and be the malignant virus, first in your family and then pouring out from there into the world.
Yeah, it's when you look in this paragraph at the examples Jesus, you know, if you just start with the specific things, he talks about overlove. And he talks about loveless maneuvering, presumably masquerading as love. And he talks about wounded love. You know, he talks about these expressions of love that you could pick up dozens of textbooks at the bookstore about overlove, loveless maneuvering, and wounded love today, on exhibition in families. So he's pointing out, like, unwise love will manifest in these false ways.
Yeah. All good things taken to extreme become bad. So there's such a thing as false love, which is specifically over love, over loving, right? And it leads to not laudable self confidence, right? It leads to self exaltation, self esteem, and up to self love. You know, or on the other end of the spectrum, as he's pointing out, right, it can be the loveless maneuvering. Right, which leads to security issues in the child.
Oh yeah, that can put a lump in a lot of people's throats. It's probably they're listening here right now if they think on their own minds.
Yeah. Okay, so right, the false love. I mean, there's a zillion ways for love to be false. Right.
Yeah.
And in a holistic sense, there's only one way for it to be true. And in a holistic way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded of, part of the difficulty, we have all these qualifiers, true love or false love and over love, anyway. But I'm reminded of, I think it's paper two. The Revelator is pained to have to use this word, this English word symbol that's so problematic to describe, the love of the Father.
Right, because of what I just said. I mean, because if you just randomly pick something when I use that word, there's there's just, like I said, there's zillions of things you'll pick up that are false love.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one thing you can pick up, which is the true love, which is what they want that word symbol to mean in terms of the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, just probabilistically, to an undiscriminating reader, you are going to pick up some false love notion and paste it on God's forehead. Right. And so it pains them. Have to use that word, but again, we've talked about this many times. This true love, false love, and how you get from the absolute individuality attitude of capital F Father love. We want to make sure that. We're not thinking just simply biologically when we're talking biologically here in an immediate context. When I say father love, I mean capital F, right? Not lowercase f, father. And you take that absolute individuality attitude to that personal realization of divine fellowship, right? The heights of your inner life. Now, and then you turn that around to become a phenomenon that isn't just unto yourself, but something that is the potential to bear fruit and flow out into your outer life. Right? As you rotate it 180 degrees, in order for it to have the proper starting point as an initiation of bearing fruit, when you rotate it like that, it has to become mother love, capital M. It has to go from that absolute individuality attitude to a cosmic totality attitude. It has to bring in wisdom. right, which is there with the mother, capital M.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not there with the father, capital F. Right? Father doesn't have a relationship to the wisdom of time. He doesn't have a relationship to time. Okay? So it's only in the consecration of your mind, the universal harmony of God the Mother, that you can properly rotate that so that, you know, what might be, you know, some budding resonance with Father love in the depths of your inner life, but then you rotate it around and make false love of it and spew it out into the world.
Yeah.
Right? That's the challenge. See, and how do you avoid that? And that's what Jesus is speaking to. Right? Yeah. There has to be wisdom. Right? There has to be the wisdom from Mother Deity and the love from Father Deity together, or you have false love. You have the malignant virus.
Is there something? Go ahead, Brad.
Oh, no, go ahead, Andrea, please.
Well, I don't have a very well-formulated question, but the idea of tough love comes to mind, and wondering how that fits in with what you're talking about. And maybe it doesn't.
That's the mode of wisdom, right? You know, the wisdom to not overplay. I mean, you know, that's part of the, you know, you just gave that example, you know, basically, you know, a little bit between the lines, but nonetheless, it's there. Of you know, the over love thing, you know, and it's like, no, you need to know when to let go. And you know, the School of Hard Knocks is authored by God as well, you know, and it's in the hands of the Supreme and in the personal hands of the Mother in the Supreme, you know, and
right.
Let that play out. I mean, you know, think about them, you know, John Mark's parents letting him go from Jerusalem over, you know, to the Jordan. I mean, do you know how many potential robbers there are along that road?
Well, I was trying to remember, how old is John Mark here? Is he 12 or 13? I'm trying to remember. I mean, it takes a lot of trust.
See, and Amos's parents are like, no way are you going to go waltzing you two off over there, right?
Well, I like to think if my kid had been hanging out with somebody like Jesus, I would have been wise enough. But, you know, I wouldn't even let my kids go past the 7-Eleven.
But see, again, Jesus isn't next door. He's clear over. You got to go down the road to Jericho, right? And I mean, that, you know, that suffocating, over-loving stuff, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right? That's unwise. That's false love.
Yeah. I really appreciate those exact words that Jesus is telling John Mark, that, you know, your parents encouraged you how to live in this world by permitting you to have original experience. I really like that.
Right. Actual possibly personal experience. See, originative, original experience.
Right.
Rather than just training a parrot.
Yeah, right. Which seems to me to be a big struggle for a lot of, I mean, not just parents, I see teachers, I mean, anyone, or just anyone in any sort of position where they're, you know, more experienced or whatever than someone else. It can take a lot of self-control to not, you know, solve a person's problem for them, you know, but to recognize, oh, this is their opportunity. This is not only, you know, this is not only an opportunity, but sort of their right to have this experience for themselves.
And, you know, we can all should be able to quickly recognize there's a hardwired tendency for the dad, the biologic dad, to just say, yeah, go ahead, you know, go over to the Jordan. But the mom can overplay her maternal instinct and suffocate.
That's why you hope you have a mother and a father together so they can balance each other.
Right.
Yeah. But they can have a marriage that isn't loveless maneuvering. That the marriage itself is founded on true love, so that they're not fighting with each other and giving you two conflicting parenting mm-hmm. philosophies, but they're harmonizing them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, and you could note there. It's like, well, wait a minute. How is loveless maneuvering false love, Chris? Well, you know, notice, but you know, he pointed out there. See, you know, you're trying to manipulate the love of the child.
Yeah.
Any said love that you think that you've, you know, achieved through this, you know, these maneuvers is not true love. It's false love.
Right. It's just a means to an end.
And see, to not just, you know, to give it those weightier terms of, you know, true and false. You know, that, you know, it's not just, well, that's socially improper. That's not nice. It's like, no, it's true and false. You know, it impacts upon the relationship to eternity of what's going on. This could have long-term consequences, false love.
Definitely.
The falsehood of eternity could play out for a very long time in time. We all know we're about to actually get that comment.
Right, right.
See, again, that's why.
Well, it's already hinted at here, this very strong phrase, personality suffering distortion. I mean, that's the more you know about the way those words are used by the revelators, the more frightening that is. Personality being distorted by parents, child's
And again, another way that you know that such a severe thing, you know, like you can think, oh, they say words like that when they're talking about Caligastia. Right, it's the loyalty.
Right.
I mean, loyalty is in play here. The foundational element of all this.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. Remember, that's the, you know, this unity phenomenon that might be, you know, way up in the clouds there with a word like love, right, comes all the way down to where the rubber meets the road with loyalty. And so, you know, see that, you know, that's, you know, remember, that's the immediate context here. You know, is the tadpole sorts of thing, and whether or not Jesus, you know, deems that the loyalty predicate in John Mark's life, was dominant, you know, and plays and will now play forward in the person that will write the Gospel of Mark.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Right. I mean, not the precept from the parents, not the example from the parents, the embodiment of loyalty in the parents. Not your words or your outward, you know, doings. Everyone should, you know, be able to immediately find the tadpole paragraph whenever you want it in the book. It's right there in section 1 of paper 100.
That's a very foundational element. Children are permanently impressed only by the loyalties. Okay. And that's that, you know. You can have fleeting impressions with precept and example, but not permanent impressions.
Mm-hmm.
Those precept and example are not existential enough to make a permanent impression. It's like I was just saying, this comes all the way down to that rubber meets the road of loyalty, right? This linkage up to eternity. You need that in play for a lasting impression.
So I wonder. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I was just going to throw it to you.
I'm not even sure how to, if this is a question or a comment or what, but it just, I will say every time I think of this section or, you know, similar implications and other passages in the book, well, maybe I should wait till a following paragraph that spells this out, but I, you know, as Brad pointed out, this personality suffering distortion, it's there's a part of me that wants to say, that's not fair. Like, what did the child do? I'm wondering where the comfort might lie in.
Yeah, well, see, again, I mean, you start to recognize that it isn't just hollow words that you've been handed a sacred trust, right? It appears to be your, you know, biologically produced child, but really it's the father's child in your hands. Hmm. It's a sacred trust.
Boy, the concept frame is everything on this. You know, there are people who have children accidentally, perfunctorily, you know, angrily. I mean, but then you could see the ones who, the day they find out that they're pregnant, like the depth of concept, the way that they reply from it. Like there's a very religious core to it, and they get it. They get that this is the father's child. But boy,
again,
you got
the father
that concept
has no relationship
frame, right?
Time. So, you know, and it's the father's child. So, you know, how the child came to be procreated, you know, is utterly irrelevant. It coming into existence is transcendent of those, you know, those temporal mechanisms or circumstances. That's, you know, that appears to be how the child came into existence, but not really.
Huh. That's interesting.
Okay. That child came into existence, you know, from the father, despite all appearances to the contrary. Right? If you could see it from the eternity viewpoint, it would be crystal clear and direct that it's the father's child. But from the time viewpoint, you know, that's way lost in the distant fog, you know, that eternity is within time. But it really is the father's child, and to know that fundamentally, and to base your parenting on that fact, right? You know, you take your parenting very seriously because you take your deputyship from the father very seriously. The father gave you a sacred trust, not the government or someone, you.
Yeah.
Much better concept frame. I'll take it. Well, Ruthie, would you like to take the reading from here?
I get to read this paragraph. Sure, thank you. Love, John, is the supreme reality of the universe when bestowed by all wise beings, but it is a dangerous and oftentimes semi-selfish trait as it is manifested in the experience of mortal parents. When you get married and have children of your own to rear, make sure that your love is admonished by wisdom and guided by intelligence.
Yeah, I've already extensively clarified this, right? I mean, it's just, love is the supreme reality when bestowed by all wise beings. Right? It's true love. Otherwise,
supreme.
It's false
right.
love.
Right.
You know, and just see, you know, that distinction. You know, there has to be this mother aspect. You know, there's, well, you know, the cosmic totality attitude that, you know, is innate in this, bringing up this word wisdom. Otherwise, it's, you know, there's no wholeness in time that can synchronize with the wholeness of eternity, truth. And so it's false love. It can't be anything else.
The way Jesus phrases this here, you know, you and I, we are not all wise beings. It's neither wisdom born of experience that we have much of, and certainly not that wisdom of eternity, we're not up for grabs for that. So it seems like it's suggesting that there will be times where our attempts to manifest love will be dangerous and could be semi-selfish. Like we will stumble, we'll skin our knees, we'll make mistakes. I mean, we're in a domain of potential evil. So that we can gain wisdom from those sorts of tribulations. I mean, if I'm not off my rocker here, that's a bit sobering. I mean, we're not going to be perfect parents because we're not all wise beings.
Right. It can't be all wise. You know, it has to have it be a supreme reality. Okay.
Right.
But none. You know, there's a hierarchy of righteousness. Right. This love can be in the context of. It doesn't have to be. You know, perfected righteousness so that it's up there at the supreme level. Goodness, you know, doesn't, you know, experientially mean perfectness. It means perfectingness, right? The perfectingness of your righteousness now, there's a wisdom, right? There are levels of wisdom. You can have, you know, there's very low rungs of the wisdom ladder. See, you know, because Mother Deity brings that supreme level down in essence. And you can strike step with the essence down at the lowest rung of wisdom and have that love be, you know, within the context of that lowest rung of wisdom. And it's still, so it's true love through, see, the ministry of that downstepping of, through Mother Deity, you get the truth. Even though, you know, it's not a supreme reality that we're talking about down there in the lowest rung. So again, it's just it's bringing that cosmic totality attitude to the best of your ability on the lowest rung of the ladder into play. In that context, put thy love. You know, admonished by wisdom, whatever wisdom you possess, guided by intelligence, whatever intelligence you possess. There's a truth to it even on the lowest rung if you are wholehearted in that effort to admonish and guide.
Mm-hmm. So on those two words, I've studied that sentence a lot. And wisdom, I think I have to the extent that I can right now, I think I have a fairly decent working definition of what wisdom is, which, you know, personal experience with divine insight. Intelligence is a little harder than I thought it would be.
The key with that is you can start by just reflecting on how you might use the word the words mental and intellectual in contrast, you know, merely mental activity and intelligence. Think of them in a hierarchical fashion, you know, if that helps, where, intelligence, you know, is a word that's indicating the upper, you know, reaches of the lower domain as opposed to the lower parts of the lower domain that are just, you know, mere mental activity.
Right.
It might be very prosaic. Okay. But that upper region that can be intelligent, see, is under the immediate illumination of cosmic insight from above. You know, see, so, it's mental activity to rationalize arbitrarily, but it's mm-hmm. intelligent to reason. Right, to start with a cosmic intuition insight for an initial assumption, right, start with a factual causal basis for your thinking, and then go from there rationally so that it's a line of reasoning. Now, that's intelligent.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that, mm-hmm. that kind of aligns with, I think, Well, I guess it's because there's still a missing piece that I think is coming together just recently. But I think how I've tried to sort through this in my mind is, okay, intelligence is the thing that is that AI can't do. Because A stands for artificial. So, you know, I've kind of, that's been a starting point. But then I came across again in paper 144 where Jesus is talking about prayer. And he has these five, bullet points. Effective prayer must be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the fourth one is intelligence, which appears to be defined right afterwards, according to light, which I think is what you're speaking to right now also.
Yes. Yes. See, that light of insight. See, another way that you can kind of immediately have a suspicion about how you should begin to think about this statement, admonished by wisdom, guided by intelligence, is like, there's a sequence there. And I remember a very fundamental sequence in the book that goes wisdom, insight, foresight. I've got wisdom. I'll bet you they're, getting to mental activity illuminated by insight and foresight when they say intelligence here. I've pointed out, you can separate the word sagacity from wisdom in the same way, where you have wisdom, and then you say wisdom and sagacity in this same order here, where the sagacity means the insight and the foresight, the intelligence illuminated by insight and foresight. See that? So you can always, there's a very structural, foundational triad there of wisdom, insight, foresight that you can overlay on almost anything that you're looking at and say, okay, so how is it playing off of that kind of the raw physics here of wisdom, insight, foresight?
Interesting. Yeah.
So, not to belabor it, but, it's yet another example. It's very important to kind of find the atoms in the book before you try to interpret the molecules in the book.
Oh, there's a new one, Chris. I haven't heard you say that before, but...
See, to find those fundamental elements, like the levels of meaning, or the threefold actuality, these elemental... facts, and don't interpret molecular sentences apart from those elemental, those atomic foundations. Otherwise, you'll have a false interpretation. Right? And so it's very key as you begin to wrap your mind around the revelation to make firm note, here's a very foundational element. So I'm, carry this forward through everything. You immediately have access to, I see what they're getting at here. They're having a particular molecular emphasis. See, like you combined, the elements of insight and foresight into a molecule called intelligence here.
I'm going to have to spend some time with that one. I have already updated our website, though, a little section on, I'm now calling it Atomic Concepts. I've been searching for the expression for that section for years.
Okay.
Thank you, Chris. The atoms.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. So this atom has this sentence has an atom followed by a diatomic molecule. See, it's like, how do you know that, Chris? Well, I know that the three atoms are wisdom, insight, and foresight.
Okay, yeah. Something to chew on. All right.
Your young friend Amos believes this gospel of the kingdom just as much as you, but I cannot fully depend on him. I am not certain about what he will do in the years to come. His early home life was not such as would produce a wholly dependable person. Amos is too much like one of the apostles who failed to enjoy a normal, loving, and wise home training. Your whole afterlife will be more happy and dependable because you spent your first 8 years in a normal and well-regulated home. You possess a strong and well-knit character because you grew up in a home where love prevailed and wisdom reigned. Such a childhood training produces a type of loyalty which assures me that you will go through with the course you have begun.
Yeah, and again, see, notice the order, loving and wise, love prevailed, wisdom reigned. I mean, so that the foundational element is the wisdom, right, or the contextual element, right, is wisdom. And again, notice it's reigned. Love prevailed because wisdom reigned. Right. That love
wisdom
prevailing, that's because it's true love. Yeah. Yeah, false love doesn't prevail because wisdom didn't reign.
So reigning like a king, what am I trying to say here? I mean, the word wisdom has the word domain built right into it etymologically.
Yes.
So the whole
yes.
idea of wisdom is that it's already a domain, and so there is a reign within that domain.
Yes. Right. It's the kingdom of heaven, right, within which love exists. It's
yeah.
the domain. See, we aren't really saying anything new. We're just putting it in this particular parental child context. It's all modeled after your inner life, the mother establishing the domain, and then the father injecting elements into that context, like love. You know,
wow.
And the mother having full ability to take that element, you know, and help you put it into the system to translate from father love to mother love.
Get it operating holistically, yeah.
See?
Yeah.
And that notice that holistically, you know, your whole afterlife. Now, we'll see in the next paragraph a little different statement. We'll talk about the contrast. But here, see, I mean, Jesus purposely says whole because he wants you to think very big picture about what he's saying. So the big picture, the ongoing philosophic concept frame, big picture afterlife will be more happy and dependable, et cetera. You know, and in that context of saying whole, you don't immediately have to wrestle with, well, do they mean afterlife? You know, in the very kind of current theological existential sense of, you know, my life after I'm resurrected, you know, after death, that afterlife, or do they mean the sense of the word afterlife? Yeah, in the experiential sense of like when I'm 9
right.
years old and 10 years old and 11 years old, right?
That's what I've heard people debate.
Right? And of course, you know, it's both, right? But here in this context, it's kind of irrelevant, right, to get into the science of the word afterlife because the word is whole.
Yeah.
And I'll say more about that, you know, after we read the next paragraph.
For more than an hour, Jesus and John continued this discussion of home life. The master went on to explain to John how a child is wholly dependent on his parents and the associated home life for all his early concepts of everything intellectual, social, moral, and even spiritual, since the family represents to the young child all that he can first know of either human or divine relationships. The child must derive his first impressions of the universe from the mother's care. He is wholly dependent on the earthly father for his first ideas of the heavenly father. The child's subsequent life is made happy or unhappy, easy or difficult, in accordance with his early mental and emotional life, conditioned by these social and spiritual relationships of the home. A human being's entire afterlife is enormously influenced by what happens during the first few years of existence.
Okay, so just obviously that last sentence is what I was hinting at, but before we get to that, you know, notice the immediacy, you know, of how they say the first impression of the universe from the mother's care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, how you know, it's very much place and direction, respectively, see,
mm-hmm.
they're speaking to there. You know, it's not the first impressions, you know, of the Heavenly Mother from the mother's care. No, it's of the universe. You know, very place and then direction, right? First ideas of the Heavenly Father, right? You know, the directionizer, right? The Heavenly Father. You know, and again, notice twice, it's wholly dependent. You know, so this very big picture. But then that last sentence, you notice the human being's entire now afterlife, said whole afterlife, its entire afterlife is enormously influenced. Okay, now, you know, in a simple English sense, the words whole and entire are synonyms. Okay, you know, the only difference immediately is that the word whole comes from Northern European andite, and the word entire comes from Latin andite.
Okay. Yeah.
But they're basically the same word. However, right, you know, they, you know, even though they sort of start at the same place in two different andite, you know, descended tongues, they end up with a differential in English that is being used here where, you know, so they're talking about the same, you know, object of consideration, yes, but whole is looking at that object more from the top down and entire is looking at it from the bottom up, you know, top down from the unity viewpoint, bottom up from the individuality viewpoint. So when they say the entire afterlife, right, you want to actually see, you're thinking a little bit more individuality, like, you know, kind of getting into the science of the word afterlife. It's like, okay, so not just when I'm 9 years old, 10 years old, 11 years old, et cetera, but even after I'm dead and resurrected and on the first mansion world, right, that entire afterlife is enormously influenced on how things get started. And,
wow.
I'll just point out for people, in the Perfecting Horizons Library, I have some reflections in there that I entitled Mental Development, where I get at some of these details and specificity about, you know, the revelators you know, pointing to the age of eight, along with the age of 12 and the age of 3, you know, and how that is tied into the developmental sequence, you know, as you begin to be able to properly interpret it with the fifth epical revelation, and how that ties into, you know, insightfully in, you know, produced systems of psychiatric consideration of humans, right, historically. So one can just, you know, go off to that and, you know, and see some of my comments there about, you know, why it says 8 years here, you know, and how that ties into, you know, the very sponge-like subjective beginnings of our agitated mindal selves prior to 8 years old. Now, and so, yeah, you're, what gets put in there in that very open, sponge-like initial state obviously is going to carry forward for a long time. Yeah. It could easily be understood to have an effect on your first and second mansion world lives.
I would agree with that, yeah.
See? Okay.
So I wonder, kind of back to the, I mean, I personally, I don't have any deep problem with this, but just on a more superficial level, I can sympathize and agree to an extent when I hear some people I have heard have a problem with this statement or this concept.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I mean, as you speak of so often, there's a physics to reality. Like, it makes sense to me. I don't have a problem with it. But I do wonder, like, what is the maybe misperception that someone is having that can be distressing? Or what is the comfort it can
Well, I mean, you know, we can start with just some factual chastening from the revelation, you know, for someone who's feeling squishy there. You know, they can read directly that I can walk up mm-hmm. to a finaliter on the Isle of Paradise, and I can tell, you know, if they started out their life male or female.
Mm-hmm.
That's a definite thing of the first 8 years of your life. You know, did you start out as a boy or a girl? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
Okay. It enormously influences. I mean, you're this experiential, accumulating experiential phenomenon that's initiated in a certain way, and that father's initiation, if you will, you're thinking that somehow you're going to transcend that initiation and be free at last from his influence? Like, no. I mean, you were initiated thus, you know, and you will carry that essence forward. Yeah, sure. You're not even going to be remotely, you know, a biologic male or a biologic female as a finaliter. Yeah, you won't go, wow, I can tell you were a female back on your nativity spirit because I can see you're completely overwhelmed by your maternal instinct still. It's like, no.
Not that, no.
Okay. You know, or I can tell you were a guy, you know, that sex urge, you still can't, you know, control it, can you? And you're like, no. Okay. Okay. But in essence, right? And again, since we're really talking about the truth of your life, not the facts of your life, it's that essence that is so indelible, see? The truths of eternity are the truths of eternity and are indelible. The facts of time accumulate around that truth nucleus of your life that began when you were young. Because you were, the father's child at conception, and at 3 months, and at 6 months, and at 9 months, and at birth, and at 1 year old, and at 2 year old, and you're the father's child. That's changeless. Okay. And so, you know, yes, the father, you know, didn't directly initiate your conception through the front door, but he did through the back door, right? And because he's the first source and center of all things and beings, things like that conception.
That's why the fatherhood of God is real. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, name me something, a reality that isn't of the father's initiation. Everything is. So, of course, you're the father's child. What else could you be? Of course, mm-hmm. that's the father's Andromeda galaxy. What else could it be? Of course, that's the father's automaton. What else could it be?
Lovely.
Okay. So, just, you know, see, like I said, that's why you have this afterlife thing, right? Which, you know, when all of a sudden that doesn't need scientific analysis. It's like, well, is it talking about when you're 8 and, you know, at 9 and 10 and 11, or is it talking about, you know, on the first match? Well, it's irrelevant, right? It's a statement of truth first. So just, you know, start with the truth always in these sorts of things, and then fill in the factual details, you know, within that framing. But again, a lot of people, you know, see, and you notice, I mean, as I'm talking about it, it brings in a lot of things that humans don't want to give to God. Like they don't want to give God a child at conception.
Yeah,
they don't want to possess that.
Our egos, our own plan, our own silly plans, they intrude in at the incessant clamoring. Yeah. Yeah.
See, and then and anything that you won't give to God is the degree to which you are apart from God and cannot survive when all is said and done.
And that's a very old message. The prophets have been telling us that for a long time. Yeah.
The only way to save your life is to let go of thinking that you possess it. It's God's. And you have a sacred trust to do something with it, knowing that it's God's.
Well, Andrea, would you like to take the reading from here?
Sure. Thank you, Ruthie. It is our sincere belief that the gospel of Jesus' teaching, founded as it is on the father-child relationship, can hardly enjoy a worldwide acceptance until such a time as the home life of the modern civilized peoples embraces more of love and more of wisdom. Notwithstanding that parents of the 20th century possess great knowledge and increased truth for improving the home and ennobling the home life, it remains a fact that very few modern homes are such good places in which to nurture boys and girls as Jesus' home in Galilee and John Mark's home in Judea. Albeit the acceptance of Jesus' gospel will result in the immediate improvement of home life. The love life of a wise home and the loyal devotion of true religion exert a profound reciprocal influence upon each other. Such a home life enhances religion, and genuine religion always glorifies the home.
Yeah, so this is a great example of some specificity around, you know, what I've pointed out recently about the divine ideals, how you can't pick and choose. Right? I mean, it's one system. There is no reality of the divine ideal of love apart from, you know, the four experiential divine ideals. Preeminence of the individual, family life, like we're highlighting here, national life, representative government even. So that, bringing that out, it can hardly enjoy worldwide acceptance, see, in some sort of false part-wise fashion. It can only be true and have the innate acceptance of truth that we're designed by our encirclement in the Holy Spirit to be resonant with. I mean, it must ring true to that human. That means it must be holistic. It must be, you know, it must have that Holy Spirit wholeness. It must be this cosmic system in its nature, not some fragmented, false subset of parts. Yeah. See, so again, it's that wholeness of righteousness, wisdom, truth, logic even, is where the reality of love is.
I certainly recognize that in different individuals I've spoken to who have, I mean, fortunately, it's not impossible to somehow, I don't know if it's reprogramming or just auto-revelation, a type of reparenting that can happen, but I have talked to multiple individuals who, I mean, it was because of, you know, one or both parents and their upbringing that they didn't see how God could be a reality at all because of that first relationship. But it's also beautiful to see how that can be overcome, but not, it seems to be in the minority.
Not easily, because like they just said in the preceding paragraph, wholly dependent,
right.
They repeated it.
Right.
You get off on a very unfortunate initial footing.
Right.
If your biologic parents don't embody cosmic truth.
It is true that many of the objectionable stunting influences and other cramping features of these olden Jewish homes have been virtually eliminated from many of the better regulated modern homes. There is indeed more spontaneous freedom and far more personal liberty, but this liberty is not restrained by love, motivated by loyalty, nor directed by the intelligent discipline of wisdom. As long as we teach the child to pray, "Our Father who is in heaven," a tremendous responsibility rests upon all earthly fathers so to live and order their homes that the word Father becomes worthily enshrined in the mind and hearts of all growing children.
And I'm emphasizing that biologic place direction differential between male and female and male respectively. And so that direction element, right, that father family, that divine ideal, the father family. So, I mean, it needs that direction. It's a tremendous responsibility rests upon all earthly fathers. So to live in order, see, that direction, order their homes. It doesn't end right in this, but it must begin in this. Right? You know, we can talk endlessly about how much of an ascending role the mother and the father play in this system, but just noticing the initiator directionizer. Is the initiator directionizer. You can't further something that hasn't been initiated. You can't further it along a particular path if it hasn't been directionized.
Right.
Okay. First things first. Seek first the kingdom of heaven, those sorts of things. Just quickly, I might point out, remember from 167:57, Jesus said that, quote, "The Father has directed the creation of male and female, and it is the divine will that men and women should find their highest service and consequent joy in the establishment of homes for the reception and training of children, in the creation of whom these parents became co-partners with the makers of heaven and earth. And for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they too shall become as one." See, notice when we talk about love and service, the highest service is the establishment of homes for the reception and training of the father's children.
We're under a minute here, folks.
Yep.
The highest service. Well, that's a fine place to leave it there. Marvelous study of a very, very key section in the book, but it's one holistic system, so in some sense all sections are key, but this one is special to us. See you back here next Tuesday. Do your best to follow the way.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you. Good night.
Yes, take care, everyone. And it is a sacred trust, but you have the full support of the God of love, So fear not, be upon you.